Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Torger Olis. I'm an attorney from Lewistown, Montana. And I'm here with full counsel Bill Berger on behalf of the plaintiff and the appellant, Fred Groves. Between myself and Mr. Berger, we divided up the time. I'm prepared to address all of the issues except punitive damages. The punitive damage issue, Mr. Berger is going to address that issue.
Okay, we have a clock there?
Yes.
Okay, whatever you leave.
Yeah, and we're going to reserve a little time
for him.
Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor.
Whenever he leaves, you can have a rebuttal.
Okay. Yeah, we understand that. Okay. Ever since 1975 in Montana, when we adopted our comparative negligence scheme, I think all plaintiff's lawyers, including myself, believed that Montana just had a simple, ordinary, humdrum, run-of-the-mill comparative negligence scheme. And we certainly felt that it would never allow the comparison of intentional versus negligent conduct in an ordinary negligence case. That belief was reinforced by Derenberger versus Ludi when the Supreme Court went a little bit over to the plaintiff's side and held for a time that gross negligence and ordinary negligence couldn't be compared to reduce the damages of a plaintiff in such a situation. Derenberger was overruled in Martel, but Martel has been the standard in Montana ever since when it held that in a negligence case, all forms of negligence could be compared, whether it was gross negligence or ordinary negligence or whatever kind of term you wanted to put on it, that conduct could be compared between the parties in the case, except and until it rose to the level of intentional conduct. Martel has been along
the statute says, on the most ordinary reading of the statute, on the sort of plain reading of the statute, doesn't seem to say that. It's 27.1702?
Yes, Your Honor, that's the comparative negligence statute. It only addresses negligence. It's a the ultimate issue in this case is whether Montana is a comparative negligence state or are we a comparative fault state where you can lump all kinds of conduct in and have the jury sort it out irrespective of to the degree of fault. In Montana, 27.1702 only speaks to negligence, and 27.1703, the statute which is entitled Multiple Defendants Determinants of Liability, again only speaks in terms of negligence. We don't have a definition of the word negligence in the statute like some states do. For instance, North Dakota, where there's a case that holds that negligence or fault includes all kind of conduct, including intentional. The only time the word fault appears in 27.1703 is in subsection 6C, which is not applicable to this case, where it just says except for persons who have settled with or who have been released by the claimant, comparison of fault with any of the following persons is prohibited. That I don't know why the legislature used the fault in that particular situation, but I know that the defendant and appellee places a lot of emphasis on that point. But certainly an overall reading of the statute makes it clear that the Montana legislature intended 27.1702 and 27.1703 to not include intentional conduct to be compared with negligence when the plaintiff sues in negligence.
And I guess the question I had is the case following that Pula. So the question, let me ask the question
sure.
First, then you can answer.
Yeah.
The difficulty I had with Pula is it says it isn't a scheme to apportion blame. So in other words, it seems to suggest that it's not just a comparative fault state. But then it takes rape as an act of intervening negligence. So I had some trouble reconciling why rape, which appears to me to be more of an intentional than a negligent act, would be different than the bus passenger situation.
Right. I think Pula is simply an ordinary everyday application of the doctrine of intervening superseding cause. And I certainly, plaintiff has no objection in the bus case with the jury's consideration of Fagnani's conduct, the drunk who started the fights, as an intervening superseding cause. I think that issue is going to arise in any case where you're suing for negligence against a defendant who's supposed to control the conduct of a third party. That issue is always going to arise. We objected to the consideration of Fagnani's conduct on the issue of apportionment of fault. And in Pula, it's simply in Pula, and I know that the appellee relies heavily on case, Pula is just an ordinary application of the intervening superseding cause doctrine. In Pula, the plaintiff sued the state of Montana for negligence because it allowed a serial rapist to eventually become a trustee at a county jail, and the rapist Bauer raped a young woman who had been in there on a minor traffic offense, and the jury was instructed on the ordinary principles of negligence and given the intervening superseding cause instruction, and simply answered the second question in the negative that the state of Montana's conduct was not the cause of the plaintiff's injuries. So I don't have any argument with Pula or what it stands for. It's simply not applicable in this case.
So you're separating causation from liability.
Yes. Well, I'm separating the doctrine of superseding cause, intervening superseding cause, from apportionment of fault, apportionment of negligence. It certainly wouldn't have been appropriate in this case, where we had the Fagnani, the drunk terrorizing the bus for two and a half hours before this assault occurred. Certainly the jury should have been considered whether or not his conduct was foreseeable on the issue of intervening superseding cause. We knew that from the get-go. That's always going to come up in these kind of cases. We believe that the evidence clearly held it was foreseeable. The jury held that his conduct was not an intervening superseding cause. And after the jury answered no on the verdict form that his conduct was not an intervening superseding cause, that should have been it as far as the jury's consideration of Fagnani's conduct for anything else.
All right, let me just make clear. 702 doesn't apply at all here, does it?
No.
Because the jury didn't find Mr. Crowe's negligent at all.
No.
And 702 is only dealing with comparative negligence.
Right.
Yeah.
So the jury found that goes to the 10%, the disappearing 10% argument. I mean, the jury found that's another issue. The jury found that Groves wasn't negligent, found that he acted intentionally in causing injuries, but his intentional conduct was excused because it was justifiable self-defense, found that his conduct was not an intervening superseding cause. So after answering all of those questions in Groves' favor, they sort of went off the shift and then assigned him 10% at fault, and the court at that point in time had an irreconcilable verdict, and should have refused to enter judgment and should have granted a new trial at that time, because there was simply no way, without engaging in wild speculation, where that 10% would go.
Is that what you're asking for, a new trial?
Yes, we're asking for a new trial, because I think that the rule of law is in the Montana cases and the Wilkes case is that once you have an inconsistent verdict, even though you're not attacking the amount of damages per se, the only way to remedy the inconsistency is to grant a new trial. And the Wills case stand for the proposition that the court isn't even supposed to enter a judgment when it finds such an inconsistency. So, and I don't want to sit down without pointing out that we have in Montana, I'm sure the court has noticed that we have a sort of a tension between the legislature and the Montana Supreme Court. I mean, we have like 702, and then we have the alternate 702. That means if the 702 was somehow found unconstitutional, the legislature has foisted upon us, especially from the plaintiff's point of view, a statute that is harsher on the plaintiffs. They did that in 271703 with our multiple defendants determination of liability. And then they enacted 271703. That's to go into effect if 703 was held unconstitutional. If you look at 705, it is a pure comparative fault scheme. So obviously, the legislature was aware of the difference. And to me, that is the clearest signal from the Montana legislature. They're saying, hey, we know what the difference between a comparative negligence statutory scheme is, and we know what the difference between a comparative fault scheme is, and we're going to give you, for now, at least the comparative negligence scheme, and as long as you don't mess with it, Supreme Court, you don't have to get the worst situation. So I don't see how that can be argued against. But I'm going to sit down and let my counterpart address the punitive damage.
Honorable judges of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, I am prepared to speak to Judge Howden's number one ruling on voir dire that no questions regarding punitive damages would be allowed, and two, that there was insufficient evidence to submit punitive damages to the jury.
May I just ask a question?
Yes.
Was there any evidence introduced to show that Greyhound knew its procedures for dealing with drunken passengers were inadequate? Was there anything introduced in the record showing past events that indicated that Greyhound should have known that its procedures were inadequate?
The evidence that was introduced was the driver's manual, the teaching manual that the drivers all go through when they are first go to school to become a bus driver. And in those, in both of those instances, in the driver's manual and the teacher's manual, it is set forth that drunk and unruly passengers pose a danger to the passenger. I would submit they pose a danger to the bus driver. And at that point, they were instructed to put the passenger off. I think it says at the closest lit stop.
The bus driver tried to do that and was unsuccessful, isn't that true?
Well, in this particular case, the bus driver at one point did have Mr. Fagnani, who was the unruly passenger, off of the bus. However, she could have left him there. She didn't have to have the police come and get him. She could have just left him there. But she said she didn't know what to do. And I think that goes is evident throughout the bus trip. She just didn't know how to deal with this guy. And even more so, because she didn't know how to deal with this guy, she was unable to communicate when he really got unruly and was threatening the little girl, and the passengers were saying, "We're all going to die." And at that point...
Those are factual issues, but do they really go to the issue of whether these procedures were in some way insufficient? I mean, the procedures were laid out there, but every situation is going to be a little different. What is it that suggests some kind of deliberate indifference by Greyhound?
Well, I think the deliberate indifference is not to allow her to have any ability to communicate with the outside world when this bus is careening down the interstate with a drunk passenger, and she had only one thing she could have done, is she could have tried to stop the bus in the middle of the night and kick the guy off. I think it's a matter of, I think the Onsted...
Let's say she had a means of communicating. What would you have done then?
She could have called the highway patrol and had them stop her on the road. She could have had at the next stop a highway patrol or a sheriff.
She already had a encounter with the police, didn't she?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
She tried to drop him off.
She tried to drop him. Well, she had him off the bus, but let him back on.
The police weren't interested.
But I don't think that just because the police aren't interested, she couldn't have left him off the bus at that time. She didn't know what to do.
But you were answering my question as to what she would have done if she had been able to call. She's already done the call on the bus. She's already talked to the police. The police are not interested. Now she's back in the bus, and she now has a ways of communicating. Does she call him back again and say...
Well, she could have called the highway patrol or another police officer for one thing, but...
So shopped, gone to a different county and so driven to a different county and tried the next police department?
Well, I think she could have left him off the bus at the time, but her training, she didn't know what to do. She should have left him off the bus when she had him off. She didn't have to let him back on the bus. But as she said in her testimony...
That might be bad judgment, but does it rise to the level of evidence that would... a punitive damages award? I mean, that's really the question. Maybe she made a bad call. In hindsight, we can say that.
I agree, Your Honor.
If a bad call is punitive damages, then punitive damages wouldn't mean anything different than ordinary damages.
Well, in this particular case, Greyhound knew that that drunks were a real problem. And they did not train her on how to deal with those drunks. I mean, their trainer's manual, their driver's manual, really is devoid of what this lady is supposed to do. And on top of that, they don't provide her with any means of communicating to anybody to come and help her. I think the Onsted case in Montana, Onsted versus Payless, is really would be totally on all fours of this case if in the bus case, the injured party would have been the bus driver. I mean, really, I see that to be the only difference. It's a matter of notification. The Onsted case says that Payless didn't provide any means of notification when this accoster came forth and accosted the employee of Payless. Well, if Mr. Fagnani would have accosted the driver, and she had no means of notification of anybody, knowing that something like that might happen or something was going to happen, I think it's about the same thing.
Was there any evidence introduced of any past incidents where the jury would have a basis to conclude that Greyhound knew it should have had a communication system?
The only evidence that was introduced as far as the communication system was is that the bus driver herself said that Greyhound's policy is that we do not provide any onboard communications, but you can have your own cell phone if you want it.
All right, so there's nothing to indicate that if there had been a communication system aboard, that everyone would have been safe based on past incidents.
Well, I think that's pretty, not based on past incidents, Your Honor, but I think that's pretty well ordinary common knowledge that if you're able to call somebody and get some help, that your situation isn't going to be as dire, and the injury can be avoided. Everybody has a cell phone anymore. I had a friend of mine that went to Tibet, and one of the things when they came back said, well, they didn't have running water, they didn't have any central heat, but one thing they all had was cell phones.
Well, who was she going to call besides police?
Highway Patrol, Sheriff, 911. Thank you. We'd like to reserve 3 minutes and 20 seconds for rebuttal.
3 minutes and 19 seconds.
Good morning. It's Michael Rapcook representing Greyhound Lines, and may it please the court. Greyhound Lines takes the position that the district court's primary error in this case was in the failure to grant Greyhound's Rule 50 motion at the close of plaintiff's case regarding the entirety of the negligence claim brought against Greyhound Lines. The basis for Greyhound Lines' Rule 50 motion was that under Montana law, and particularly given the circumstances of this case, it is the responsibility of the district court to determine whether or not the plaintiff has established a duty in the defendant, a duty which is cognizable under Montana law. Specifically, in determining whether or not there is a duty, Montana has undergone a reexamination of its tort law and has, in a decision entitled Busta versus Columbus Hospital, reestablished the general analysis of the famous Paul's Graph case in determining the nature of a duty. And what the court has declared is that a duty is established when the plaintiff is able to show that it is reasonably foreseeable that a particular event will occur such that the defendant is put on notice of the need to do something about that event in advance. It is the obligation of the court in its gatekeeping function to make that determination. Indeed, in Busta, the Supreme Court recommended very strongly against submitting questions concerning foreseeability to the jury and specifically stated the jury should not generally be instructed on the question of foreseeability. It is, therefore, ultimately a question of law for the court to decide, and the court erred in deciding to let this matter proceed to the jury. The facts of this case establish the error clear and unambiguously. And the facts of this case are that there was no conceivable way of predicting the response of Fred Groves to what happened in Dickinson, North Dakota. The district court recognized this as a problem, and the district court expressed concern, but nonetheless allowed the matter to go to the jury in a manner inconsistent with the law of Montana.
Well, let me say, in your briefs you argue that Fagnani did not intend to injure Groves' knee. That surprised me because I don't have no case, and maybe you can tell me one, that says it has to be foreseeable that he would injure the knee.
Your Honor, I believe you're correct. And in fact, I believe the Montana Supreme Court has clarified that in the decision entitled Samson that came out a short time ago, that you don't have to be able to foresee the injury. But that really isn't the point. You have to be able to foresee the conduct that would lead to the injury, and that conduct is the conduct of Fred Groves in his reaction to the slap. And remember that the evidence in this case established through Ms. Houston was that Mr. Fagnani merely slapped Mr. Groves. The determination has to be that it was possible for the bus driver to foresee that Mr. Groves would, and again, in the words of Ms. Houston, flip out, not only cold cock Mr. Fagnani, knocking him against the windshield of the bus, cracking it so that he slumped to the floor, but then jumping on top of him and hitting him several more times, and in the process of doing that, injuring his knee.
Wasn't there a question for the fact that the disputed issue as to whether or not Mr. Fagnani was subdued before Mr. Groves jumped on him after he smacked him?
Your Honor, if you look carefully at Mr. Groves' testimony, I believe the answer to that question is no. And I, with all due respect to the Court's rule, I'm reading at length from the record. I do have just a brief reference from the record that I would like to point out to the Court. Specifically, it is in the trial transcript at pages 672 to 673, and you can find it in defendant's appendix, excerpts of record, as on page 180. The question asked of Mr. Groves by his own attorney was, did you hit Mr. Fagnani back? His answer was, yes, I did. The question was, just as you showed there, and he answered, yes. Then what happened, and Mr. Fagnani responded, I remember his falling backwards, his head hit the passenger side windshield, it cracked, and then he slid down to the floor, and then the next thing I remember, I was hitting him on the head a few more times. In other words, what Mr. Groves' testimony, without any additional gloss by his attorney, established was that his actions in jumping on top of Mr. Fagnani were utterly unconscious.
Well, didn't he also testify that he was concerned because there were other passengers on the bus, and he was concerned that Fagnani may pose a threat, that he might have a knife or a gun? But if you continue to read in that passage of the testimony and you put it all together, isn't that what he says?
Your Honor, that certainly is the story that the plaintiff attempted to tell at trial. However, when you look at the, as it were, bare reading of what Mr. Groves did, his reaction had nothing to do with threats of guns nor concern about other passengers. His reaction was to cold cock Mr. Fagnani, crack the windshield with his head, and then, as he said, the next thing he knew, he's on top of Mr. Fagnani. There was no consideration by his own testimony of any of these other factors. And given that unconscious and clearly excessive response to what had happened here, he had merely been slapped.
I'm sorry. I don't understand what you're saying.
What I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is...
You say it's unconscious. Where did he get that?
Again, from Mr. Groves' testimony. The next thing I knew, I was on top of him.
He gets involved in an altercation where blows are being struck back and forth. Obviously, the person involved would think they're involved in something dangerous. And, you know, I don't quite understand your point.
Your Honor,
if they're supposed to sit there and cogitate, you know, hitting him one more time make a difference. I mean, presumably you would subdue the person so that the danger that the person poses doesn't continue.
Your Honor, the issue is not, and we have not appealed the jury's determination of whether or not Mr. Groves' conduct was "quote unquote justifiable use of force."
Well,
that's
why I'm sort of wondering.
The question.
What your point is.
The question is one of foreseeability and therefore of damages. In other words, could Greyhound, through its bus driver, realistically have expected that Mr. Groves, without thinking and having, by his own testimony, knocked Mr. Fagnani down to the ground, would jump on top of it and in the process injure his own knee?
Your point is something totally ridiculous. I don't know.
Well, Your Honor...
You know, that they have to predict every move in an altercation. The plaintiff's case, and, you know, you can dispute it or not, is that, look, there's a drunk on the bus, the bus driver was not trained to deal with that situation. The bus driver didn't have equipment to call for help. And what happens when you put a drunk in the midst of a group of peaceful people, you can get a dangerous situation. You can get a situation where violence erupts, and things then move very quickly. I don't think they have to predict that the guy is going to hit him six times, as opposed to five times, or three times, as opposed to two times. Once violence erupts, I think most people would expect that it would continue until one of the parties is subdued, hopefully the initial aggressor. Now, not that you would sit there and hit him and say, okay, buddy, you got enough, or do I have to hit you again? I don't think that's how things play out in real life. I don't think that that Greyhound can be expected, they can expect it to go this far, not that far. The point is, this was a dangerous situation. They, according to plaintiffs, and you can dispute this if you want, your client helped bring it about by failing to train the bus driver to deal with it and failing to give her the means to call for help. I think there's sort of this thin slice of the salami. It didn't work with the jury. It's not going to work with us.
Well, Your Honor, I do dispute the lack of training, and I do dispute the issues concerning onboard communication.
That,
I will, Your Honor.
Try to. I don't get it.
Well, as I say, the question of foreseeability was for the court in terms of Montana law, and the court had to ask of Greyhound that it see all the way down the road.
I'm sorry. This was submitted to the jury, right?
It was, Your Honor.
Okay, let me.
However.
Over objection.
Over objection. However.
Over Greyhound's objection.
Correct.
And your position is that foreseeability may not be submitted to the jury.
Foreseeability, given the case law in Montana, given the circumstances of this case, were such that the court could and properly would have ruled that ultimately what happened with Mr. Groves in the end was unpredictable.
It may be that you're right, that if the court had decided to take foreseeability from the jury, maybe we would sustain that. But it didn't. You must persuade us that it erred in submitting it to the jury. And the law of Montana would be very strange indeed if it precluded a judge from submitting foreseeability to a jury. Is it quite that strange? Is Buster that strong a precedent? I didn't read it as being that strong, but I am here to be educated. You show me where Buster says that.
Well, Your Honor, I would refer to court.
Where one can do a Buster is your precedent, is right? Or Busta or Busta?
It's Busta, as I understand it, Your Honor, and I would refer
it's
to court.
It's Busta and Pula, right?
Yes.
Not Busta and Pula.
Well, I'm assuming,
okay,
Your Honor. I wasn't involved in either case, so I'm just
exactly.
Guessing.
Okay, but we're talking about the same case, and I have it in front of me, and I am anxious to be educated by you.
Well, Your Honor.
What is it that says a trial court errs when it submits foreseeability to a jury? And I, even though they say in so many words, what is the language on which you rely for that inference?
I'm looking, Your Honor, at the Montana version, the Montana Reporter version.
You just tell me where it is. I can.
We further, if I may, Your Honor, we. Quoting from the case, we further recommend the terms such as proximate cause or legal cause are reasonable.
Excuse me. I didn't mean you could just start reading.
I'm sorry, Jeff.
You have to sort of tell me where you are. I can't guess that.
I'm attempting. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So tell me, you know, it's sort of a page number or a paragraph number or.
I have one.
In the discussion section about halfway down. So give me a hint.
I have 140, I should say.
140, did you say?
Page 140 of the Montana Reporter.
Okay, I have no trouble finding page 140. I'm with you. Just give me. Okay. I'm with you. Okay. Page 140. That's easy.
Making reference to the first column.
Okay. And is the paragraph that starts in those cases?
No, Your Honor. It is the paragraph that... The court may be right. Let me look back at the paragraph.
You don't have...
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Okay. We're together. Go.
The court stated, we further recommend that terms such as proximate cause or legal cause or reasonable foreseeability, which have some significance to lawyers and judges, not be allowed to confuse jurors by the inclusion of those terms in jury instructions. The court...
Well, but that is a different proposition than saying you don't submit the issue to the jury. I thought, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought what they were saying is don't use confusing lawyers' jargon. Like proximate cause, because who knows what proximate cause is?
Well, but it does say foreseeability, and the question of foreseeability was submitted to the jury. And from my reading of Boosden, as well as the state of Strever versus Klein, this is ultimately a legal question.
To the extent that foreseeability raises the jury issues, it is adequately addressed by the definition of negligence, including Montana Federal Instruction 200.
I see that language, Your Honor, but in this particular case, the specific issue of foreseeability in that language was submitted to the jury, and it's the position of Greyhound that that was error given the circumstances.
Did you object to the special verdict form?
Your Honor, we did not.
And the special verdict form uses the phrase not reasonably foreseeable, does it not?
It does. Turning my attention then to the issues raised by the plaintiff, and with specific reference to the issue of comparison of intentional conduct and negligent conduct. In the first place, I believe that Judge Kaczynski is right in saying that the statutes relied upon by the plaintiff in arguing that only quote-unquote negligent conduct can be compared do not specifically say that. And in fact, the statute that creates obligations and upon which we preface causes of action in the state of Montana is Section 27-1-701, which specifically holds parties liable for both their intentional and negligent conduct. Furthermore, the distribution or attribution of fault statute, Section 27-1-703, contains no specific prohibition on the consideration of an intentional conduct and does, in fact, contain a reference to the term fault.
Okay, let me step back. What is the relationship between the fault statute of 701, which basically just says Hornbook law, which is you can get nailed for either intentional or negligent acts? That is not necessarily to be read as a statement of how you apportion comparative fault, is it? I mean, that basically just says you can get liability for one or the other in Montana.
The court is correct. However, the examination of whether or not the types of conduct at issue here can be compared is ultimately determined not specifically by reference to the statutes, but by the Supreme Court's decision in Pula. And let me explain Pula in greater detail than was explained by counsel for the appellant.
I'm sorry, you're jumping around. You started off by telling us the statutes support your case. And then Judge McEwen asked you about 701, which doesn't seem to do that at all. All it says is you're liable for either negligence or intentional tort. If you agree with that, he said, but don't
worry. Well, now let's go to 702. It basically says that as long as your contributory negligence isn't greater than the other person, then you can recover under 702, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And then 703 then just talks about negligence also.
Attribution of liability between negligent parties.
Well, 703 is the one that you rely on, right? 703.1.
Yes, Your Honor.
It says, if the negligence of any party to an action is an issue, each party against whom recovery may be allowed is jointly and severally liable. The first phrase deals with negligence. The second phrase deals with all people who are liable. I thought that was your argument.
It is partly, Your Honor. However, that language does not specifically exclude the consideration of intentional conduct, and in fact, our argument is, by implication, allows that consideration.
How?
Because when it says, if the issue of negligence is at issue, it does not declare that only that issue can be considered by the finder of fact. Further in the statute, it does discuss the question of joining parties whose conduct may constitute fault and under what circumstances you may do so.
And then where do you get the notion that it's a comparative fault state? Because joint and several liability is joint and several liability.
Well, Your Honor, ultimately, the issue of comparative fault has to be analyzed, again, under the Pula decision, and from the perspective...
No, I'm trying to understand from the statutes, because if you look at the statutory scheme around the country, you have comparative fault states, you have those that relate solely to negligence, and there seems to be a pretty clear dividing line if you read the statutes. I'm reading the Montana statute, and...
Your Honor, with all due respect, I think it is the absence of a discussion, a specific prohibition on the comparison of fault that is most relevant here. And again, in the limited time
well,
no, I have...
Well, I want to understand. So you're saying that because Montana doesn't explicitly prohibit it, it therefore must permit comparative fault?
I'm asking the Court to consider the entirety of Montana law, and specifically... the general requirement, Hornbook law, that in any tort case, the elements of duty, breach, causation, and damages have to be established, and the focus of Pula is on the issue of causation. And let me argue...
But then it also said in Pula that one of the things the Court was not doing was, quote, how to apportion blame among several liable parties. What do you think the Court meant by that?
Your Honor, I'm not entirely sure what the Court meant by that, but I think
I thought
one thing
pretty
is
clear. So maybe I'm missing. What do you want us to do with that phrase?
Well, in the first instance, I think that what Pula stands for is the proposition that the conduct of all persons who may have caused the injury may be considered on the issue of causation, and that's unambiguously set out, and that is not limited to the issue of intervening superseding causation. The jury found the state of Montana was not a cause. It didn't reach the question of intervening superseding causation.
Assume that's true. They go on to say, but this does not have anything to do with apportioning damages in that same case.
True, Your Honor, but it does establish that a jury may consider when you have two or more actors, and in a case like this, you have an actor, Mr. Fagnotti, whose conduct is indispensable to the very existence of the cause of action, that you may consider all of that conduct in determining whether or not a critical element of the cause of action has been satisfied, and that's the element of causation. When you have...
Do you think we should send this to the Montana Supreme Court to resolve the issue?
Frankly, Your Honor, I don't think it's necessary. I think that in this case... given that we have a substantial factor test.
I see. So your answer is, if I'm going to win, decide the case anyway, but if I'm going to lose, send it to Montana first. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor. I think that...
Even if you're going to lose, we should decide.
Well, Your Honor, I think it is up to this court.
It's a significant question of state law.
It is. And I'm simply suggesting to the court that given the law of the state of Montana, and specifically with reference to the Pula decision, that... there's no need to send the matter to the Montana Supreme Court. If the court, in its wisdom, decides that the Montana Supreme Court should look at the issue, we're certainly prepared to deal with the issue at the Montana Supreme Court.
Montana does have a certification procedure.
My understanding, Your Honor.
It does.
They do. Takes a long time.
Let me ask another question about 703, on which you depend. 703-4 says specifically, second sentence, for purposes of determining the percentage of liability attributable to each party whose action contributed to the injury complained of, the trier of fact shall consider the negligence of the claimant, injured person, defendants, and third party defendants. It does not say intentional act, but you wish us to imply that that's what it says.
Your Honor, what I'm suggesting is that the statute has to be considered in light of general principles of tort law. And that's what the Pula decision stands for. And whether or not the plaintiff has satisfied the burden in any tort case of establishing causation. And the court did hold in that case, on the basis of a jury verdict that did not even reach the question of intervening superseding causation, but simply said the state of Montana's negligence, they did find the state negligence was not a cause of the injury, and allowed the jury to consider the conduct of a rapist, that the issue on the question of causation regarding the conduct of intentional conduct can be considered. Furthermore, in this case, there is an additional question of whether or not the conduct of Mr. Fagnani is intentional or negligent anyway. That issue was submitted to the jury carefully by the district court on the question of causation. And the jury found two causes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In rebuttal, I think it would be improper for this court to read in any language into 703. I think that flies in the face of any type of principle of statutory construction. And I think that this court has the benefit, I mean, because we have these unusual statutes that says, well, this one's the law until you hold it unconstitutional, then this one applies. That when you look at 705, the Montana legislature did know the difference between a comparative fault and comparative negligence scheme, and Montana clearly falls on the side of that we have a comparative negligence scheme. Pula has nothing to do with anything other than it's a standard intervening cause instruction. And if you look at the verdict form that the judge submitted...
It is a bit of a vexing question, though, isn't it?
Pardon me?
It is a bit of a vexing question if you... I neglected to point out to you what it was about the language of the statute that I found troubling. I had trouble finding the exact language, but I was looking at 703... the first sentence.
Right.
That seems to, in the first phrase, when I asked you the first question, I said the language of the statute seems to support the district court, and that is the first part of this of the sentence talks about negligence, but then when it talks about apportionment, it talks to anybody who be liable. And to me, at least, it's a plausible reading. So it's in the negligence of party and action and issue. So if you're dealing with a situation where a party is charged with negligence, each party against whom recovery may be allowed. Okay, and this doesn't necessarily mean, as we know from 701 and from just common law, you don't not merely negligent people, but also intentional tort feasors.
Right.
So at least the statute to me seems to create an ambiguity, and I would even say it's the more plausible reading. And that doesn't. What do you do with that?
Well, I don't think that what I do with it is I don't think if you read 702 and 703 together, it's clearly it only applies to negligence.
Not
then, Your Honor,
sure
if you look at 705, that answers the question.
Okay.
If you look at 705.
I do have 705. What does 705 say?
705 talks about comparison of fault.
Okay, give me a language, a subsection. You give me something.
But it's in the first sentence when it 705. I don't have it in front of me, Your Honor, but I know that what it says. It says that
it says a justification described in 102 and 104, which is something else. I don't know what it is not available to a person who is doing certain things.
Yeah.
That has to do with a different thing.
705 does away with joint and several liability. It applies several liability only, and it speaks in terms of...
I'm sorry, I was reading 105.
Yeah.
So I don't know what 705
says. Oh, so excuse me, 105 is the... 105 is the statute.
It is the statute?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, now how does that happen?
Well, that statute... only applies if 703 were to be held unconstitutional, and it is the statute that indicates to me, and I pointed out in my brief, that the legislature in Montana knew the difference between a comparative negligence scheme and a comparative fault scheme. And if 703 were to be held unconstitutional, we would end up with a comparative fault scheme. And to me, that's the clearest language of the clearest indication of legislative intent that the legislature intended 703 to apply to negligence only. And the answer, Judge, to your question is, I go back to the Martel case that says that we hold, therefore, that all forms of conduct amounting to negligence in any form, including but not limited, et cetera, are to be compared with any conduct that falls short of conduct intended to cause injury or damage. Now, to me, Martel is the controlling case, and Martel stands for the proposition that in these kind of cases, we're not supposed to compare intentional conduct and negligent conduct when we apportion liability.
Martel talks about Montana being a comparative negligence state.
Right, and we adopted our statute.
Then there's these legislative changes. Does that change anything?
No, the legislative changes... Maybe I'm not explaining it very well because it is kind of unusual, but we have an alternative statute to 702 and we have an alternative statute to 703. In the event those statutes were held unconstitutional by the Montana Supreme Court, then the legislature provided that the second 702 and 705 will come into effect. They don't like what the Montana Supreme Court does. I mean, they want to have the last word in Montana, the legislature does. So they're saying you have a comparative negligence scheme, but if you tinker with it, we're going to give you something worse. That's what they're saying. We're going to give you, from the plaintiff's point of view, we're going to give you a comparative fault scheme. And so to me, that's the clearest indication that the legislature recognizes we have a comparative negligence scheme. Because they know what a comparative fault scheme is and they could have enacted it. And Martel is the controlling authority. And on question number 9, on the verdict form that the judge submitted, was the difference that I'm trying to make, it's, the question was the intentional conduct of Gilbert Fagnani an unforeseeable and intervening superseding cause of Fred Grove's injuries? The jury answers no. Then that is the end of the consideration of Mr. Fagnani's conduct in this case. It is proper to ask that question in any kind of case like this, but then you don't get to apportion liability. Because
I think that you don't recommend sending the case to Montana.
I have no objection to sending it to Montana because I know what I'm confident in what they say.
And apart from sending it to Montana Supreme Court, you want us to reverse the use of intentional
right.
Negligible.
That's correct. It has to be reversed because it's an inconsistent verdict because of the 10% that just simply went out the window. Reversed because the verdict form was improper because it allowed the jury to compare Fagnani's intentional conduct with the negligent conduct of Greyhound in violation of the statutes of the state of Montana.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Case society will stand submitted. We'll next hear argument in the Sierra Club versus Mineral County case. We like to keep counsel guessing.